Dr. Stuart Jameson is an internationally renowned heart surgeon, a heart-lung transplant pioneer, a veteran of more than 40,000 heart surgeries over his career. He is Distinguished Professor of Surgery and Dean of Cardiovascular Affairs at University of California, San Diego, where he's been since 1989. And he's written a new book about not just all these heart surgeries that he's performed, but how the procedure has changed, and about his upbringing in Africa. He joins us on the line right now. Dr. Jameson, good morning.
Good morning, Paul.
Pretty amazing life. What made you decide to put pen to paper and write your memoir?
Well, Paul, it started to be a book about the history of heart surgery, which is one of the greatest stories of the last century. I was born in 1947 in Africa. But when I was born, there was no heart surgery. So had I been born with a heart defect, I would have died. And the very first heart surgery in the world was done in 1952 at the University of Minnesota in a young girl, age 5, Jacqueline Johnson. She was exactly my age at the time. And nowadays, we take heart surgery for granted. It happens all the time. We operate every day on people's hearts, we stop them, we do complicated procedures, we start them again and think nothing of it. But then in the early 1950s, there was no heart lung machine. So when you stop somebody's heart, you have to have a machine to take over the heart's function. And that oxygenates the blood, it pumps the blood. You can stop the heart for hours at a time, actually, and do complicated heart surgery, but not so in the 50s. And so the very first heart surgery was done by a man called F. John Lewis. And he took this 5-year-old girl, exactly my age at the time, cooled her down with blocks of ice. And when the metabolism had slowed, opened her chest, stopped the heart, and was able for a period of 5 minutes to repair a simple hole going into the heart. And so that was the first heart surgery.
Wow.
But the problem with that, of course, is that you've only got 5 minutes
right,
to do all the surgery. And we had to wait for the other developments to make heart surgery what it is today.
Well, and you were there at the forefront of some of those developments. You will celebrate this year your 40th anniversary of your first heart transplant operation, which you write about in great detail in the book. As you describe it, tell us about that moment and why it is still so moving to you.
Yeah, well, this was in 1979. And at that time, in the 70s, heart transplantation was still considered experimental. And most centers had given up heart transplantation because the results were so bad. The difficulty wasn't so much doing the operation, which is a mechanistic thing. It was how to control the body subsequently so that it wouldn't reject the organ, give too much immunosuppression, then the patients also got infections. So at that time, things were still somewhat tenuous in doing heart transplantation. I remember that particular operation because it was on July the 4th, 1979, and it was on a 20-year-old man who was suffering from terminal disease of the heart. And we took this big, swollen, dying heart out, threw it in a bucket on the floor, and then looked into the chest. And here was a human being with an open chest and with the machine gone. There was no heart there. But kept alive, of course, because we had the heart-lung machine. And that patient who was 20 is now going to be 60 this year. So 40 years on, a good result.
Absolutely incredible. Why did you choose medicine as a career, and why did you choose to study in London?
Well, so in Africa, in the 50s, Africa was very much sort of colonial outpost. And there was no university to go to where I lived at that time. And so it always was a given that I would leave what was then Rhodesia is now Zimbabwe, and go to college and university. And it was a question of either going to South Africa or going to England. So, yeah, I went to England in 1966 to go to medical school. And I explain in the book, I'd grown up on this 2.5 million acre ranch with animals all around. It was like living in a zoo, really. And I thought everybody lived that way until I was about 8, and I went away to boarding school. I had a pet giraffe and a pet zebra, and it was an adventurous life, but it was not sustainable at that point. I mean, there were many political reasons, but I ended up going to medical school in London, and I went to St. Mary's College, which was part of the University of London, and it was a great choice for me because it was where the first kidney transplants had been done in Europe, where it was where penicillin was discovered by Alexander Fleming. It was a very rich environment for somebody who was interested in transplantation. And I was fascinated by the possibility of taking a dying organ, and indeed a dying person, and putting a new organ in them and converting them back to normal activity. This was a fascinating time that we were able to do that. And the only person successfully doing transplants at that time was Dr. Shumway at Stanford University. And I managed to get a fellowship to go work with him for a year in 1978. And that 1 year turned into two turned into three. And I stayed at Stanford for 10 years. And I was very lucky to be in the right place at the right time. At the age of 34, I was the director of the heart and lung transplant program and the only person in the world doing heart and lung transplants. So it was a great opportunity that was given to me, and I really tried to make the most of it.
One of the biggest obstacles to doing this kind of surgery is finding donors. I guess maybe talk a little bit about that. Is there a shortage of organ donors, and what do we do about that?
Well, Paul, it's a very, very good point. We do less than 2,500 heart transplants in the United States every year. And the limitation is entirely the amount of donors. And obviously, more than 2,500 people in the United States die every year from injury or trauma or accidents. But the number of donors that come available for transplantation has been stuck at around 2,500 for the last 20 years. And we've tried everything to increase people's awareness of the need for donors. Many, many more people die waiting for transplants that actually have transplants. And I think it's a matter of public awareness. In Europe, they have a slightly different rule, and that is presumed consent. So if you have an accident in Europe and you are brain dead, you are assumed to be a donor unless you've indicated that you don't want to be. Here it's the other way around. We've got to ask the family all the time, and oftentimes there are emotional, religious reasons that they don't want to go ahead. But the donor supply, you're absolutely right, is the critical impediment we have.
Talk with Dr. Stuart Jameson, a pioneer in heart and lung transplant surgery. Dr. Jameson, if you were starting your career today, if you were a young man in medical school, would you still pick transplant surgery, or is there something else on the horizon that would attract you?
Yeah, there's always something new. Mm-hmm. And after my first heart transplant, you put a new heart in somebody's chest, it starts beating away. It's a miraculous thing. And I thought, I've climbed the mountain. After this, there will be no other great achievements. But that wasn't true. We then started to do combined heart and lung transplants, and then lung transplants. We now do much more sophisticated surgery that we do, that both in adults and children, than we did 20 years ago. We're now doing robotic surgery. One of the projects I'm working on is to be able to do the robot operation here in San Diego, but the patient will be the other side of the world in India or or China. And that technology is very possible. So there's always something new and exciting. If I was starting now, it might not be transplantation anymore because much of the problems have been worked out.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many exciting new terrific projects on the horizon.
Really interesting stuff, Dr. Jamieson. We appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. Bye now.